Deep-rooted native plants also help the soil absorb more water, reducing runoff and erosion. And though establishing pollinator habitat costs more upfront than planting grass, Grinstead says it can save money over time on mowing and maintenance. So there are many benefits to transforming the ground around solar panels into habitat buzzing with life. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 27th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dave Johnson, Craig Woods, Landon Ruiz, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Tramel Gomes, Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Zamon Perez, Isabel Charlet, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast version of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. As I've talked about on the show before, the Trump administration is using every tool available to target public lands and our mature and old growth forests, along with, of course, democracy, basic human rights, any shred of protection against the corporate oligarchy, etc., etc. But this is primarily a show about Northwest conservation and climate, so as much as I want to rant about all the things, I'm going to keep it focused and get back to forests. So as we gear up for what could be a new round of the timber wars, I've been thinking a lot about the elders and unsung heroes of our community. We have a lot to learn from the OGs of the environmental and forest defense movements, and aside from that, they deserve to be celebrated. So I'm excited to be interviewing some of these folks over the next few months. First up, my guest today is Frances Etherington. Frances has been defending our Northwest forests for decades, and I'm honored to have the chance to talk with her and learn from her wisdom and experience. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime with guest ideas, feedback, or if you're interested in helping make this show. Okay, let's get to the interview. Frances Etherington, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to talk with you today. And I have a lot that I want to ask you, so we'll do the best we can in the time we have. But I want to just ground us in this conversation asking you to describe yourself and your life of activism. How would you put that into words?
Well, as an activist, you know, probably I'm best at being a professional complainer, and I know how to complain against especially clear-cutting by federal agencies. The federal agencies is where we're able to put in our most influence. I think my activism started when I saw my first clear-cut as a tree planter in Hodads, and I'd never seen a clear-cut before, and I went, holy cow, they're allowed to do this, right? So then was hanging out with all those folks who knew a lot about the Forest Service and BLM. And I went on to form a company called Three Sisters Forestry. me and some of my friends were bidding on the Forest Service timber stand exams. They want an inventory of what they own. And so we bid on those contracts, and we were able to work in the Umpqua National, all over the Umpqua National Forest and the Deschutes National Forest. And we got to say clear cuts were awful, and the old growth we were in, we got to say, you know, this is not loggable. You can't log this. And we didn't really recommend silvicultural prescriptions. We just told them what was there. So one day I got a phone call from my friend Diana Wales, and she said, you know, there's a group forming in Roseburg you might be interested in. They're complaining about timber sales. And so she told me where to go, and I went. And it was the first organizational meeting of a group called Umpqua Watersheds. And they had not gotten a 501c3 or anything, but they wanted to look at the salvage logging rider, which had just come out. And what are these sales in the salvage logging rider? And we should be concerned about them.
And this is back in the 90s, correct? In the Clinton back administration?
Yes, right. This is mid-90s, yeah. And so we all had maps, but you know what? It was hard to read those maps. I mean, if you get a forest map out, it's like you're looking at a plate of spaghetti roads. And GPS had not yet been invented, right? So no one could find these sales except for me, since I'd been working out there for a couple decades anyway. So that's what started the official complaining about the timber sales that the federal government was doing. And I got versed in how to do it properly with NEPA, and I became what I call a professional complainer. And I was able to really pick apart these timber sales. And for a long time, the federal government will put out EAs on, we're going to clear cut this old growth forest, right? And so we go take pictures and ask the public to put in comments. Umpqua Watersheds had one of the very first web pages. I mean, internet just...
Yeah. Yeah, you don't mean like the first... One of their first web pages. You mean one of the first web pages.
One of the first web pages ever. We got written up in the New York Times about it too. Oh, look, environmental groups are doing web pages.
Oh, I love that.
And I wanted to put up pictures of this old growth, and I had pictures, but the problem was every picture that you have to go from your camera to digital to put on the web, you had to pay $5
wow.
to digitize that picture. So, you know, that's how we started paying $5 for every picture we put on the web of people standing by old growth that's going to be cut.
Yeah. You know, Francis, I actually want to go more into your experience with the HODADs and your experience starting your own company. But actually, before we get there, I want to take this chronologically, if that's okay. I want to know where you grew up. What was your childhood like? Because I'm kind of curious about people's backgrounds and how they lead them into activism. So, yeah, what was your childhood like? Where'd you come from?
I was born in DeKalb, Illinois, 1949. And I went to college at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, and I graduated with a degree in anthropology. And me and my friend Valerie, we had a little run on this selling marijuana. And suddenly we made all this money. And so what are we going to do? We decided that we needed to buy land before civilization fell, and that Missouri was not the place to do it. All the happenings, you know, in 1975 was out on the West Coast. So we came to the West Coast, and we had some zines that described where different places where activism was going on. We had a Woman's Spirit magazine that came out of Wolf Creek, Oregon. We thought, oh yeah, let's hook up with that group, right? Because we were lesbians. And so we actually founded a piece of land designed to be a collective piece of land. We founded outside of Roseburg, Oregon. The real estate agent led us here when we told her we wanted to be remote. She said, I know just a place, and it's got several buildings on it to sleep in. So yeah, so that we got here, we called it Rainbow's End because we saw a big rainbow and we were at the end of it, right? It had nothing to do with being gay at that time. Rainbows wasn't about being gay. But anyway, this land is Rainbow's End, and I've been here for 50 years now. And it's just a gorgeous place. We are lucky to be at the end of a road with 209,000 acres of no people behind us.
Wow.
Industrial forest land, the Milacoma tree farm is behind us. And then I got a job at the museum doing oral interviews. And then my other friend, after a while, she said, well, listen, I'm going to join this all women's tree planting crew. And I said, oh, man, that sounds like fun. So I quit the museum. And I went to tree planting. And it was an all-women's tree planting crew out of Hodads. Hodads was a collective, kind of a hippie collective of forestry workers. And they would get the projects in from the federal government and bid on them. And then assign the work duty to the different groups that were a part of Hodads. And our group was called Half and Half. It referred to our pay system, which was half piece, half share. Huh. And I was with that group for a couple years. And then for a couple years, we did timber stand exams for the Forest Service. And then some of us left the Half and Half group and we founded our own company called Three Sisters Forestry. And we bid on inventory work in the Pacific Northwest. It was great fun. We had to live out of our cars in the middle of the forest, in the middle of nowhere. And we made tons of money. I mean, it's a guy's job, right? I never was used to making so much money. It's great.
that was back when those kinds of jobs paid well, I imagine.
Well, we bid our work. So sure. We just had to figure out what the next bidder would be if you only won the work if you were low bidder.
Uh-huh.
The question was, how much money did you leave on the table? What was the second lowest bidder? And if you were really close and that you're paying as high as you could. So.
Yeah. I mean, that is so fascinating, and that must have taken, you know, it takes a special kind of person to, especially being gay at that time, to move to a rural area, then to get into the forestry world. I mean, you don't strike me as someone who is phased easily, but I didn't know you back in your 20s or, you know, however old you were then, so. How was all that experience for you? Was that difficult? Was it scary? Did you encounter a lot of pushback, sexism?
Well, there was rampant sexism back in those days, even by the folks who were really trying not to be. And it took a little education process on our part to help smooth that out. And I was glad I was a lesbian. I mean, I was like, I'm a lesbian, you know? And then there was lots of lesbian groups around, you know, like my whole tree planting group was all women, half lesbian. So it's not like we were unique or short or, you know.
You had like a support network.
Oh, absolutely. Support network, you know, my family, friends, crewmates, lesbians and all of them. So.
Wow. Well, I love that. So, you know, at some point, you transitioned from doing these timber sales, doing tree planting, to fighting against timber sales. And I don't want to skip over anything in between, but how did you make that transition?
You know, I had heard on the radio about protests blocking a road on $8 Mountain down in Medford. And I thought, gosh, you know, I'd like to get involved in something like that. But, you know, I had no idea how to get involved in something like that.
And so, and when was that? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that was probably early 90s.
Okay. So how did you then go ahead and get involved in that?
I had a friend call me. Her name was Diana Wales. And she said to me, you know, I know about a group that's meeting at the pizza parlor tonight. And I bet you would enjoy them. Why don't you go? They're wanting to do forestry work. So I said, okay, and I was still actively doing forestry work myself. But I went to this group, and they wanted to go check out local timber sales. And I thought, oh, I didn't know that you could actually know about timber sales and go check them out beforehand, and that the BLM and the Forest Service and the whole public process, I learned very quickly the whole public process and just jumped right in because I wanted to be part of the public process. And started going out and look at some of the logging rider sales for this group. Penny Lynn Once we formed an official group and applied for a 501c3, Penny Lynn was the executive director. Penny was just a wonderful help. Patrick Starnes was the outreach coordinator, and I was the conservation director, because now I knew how to look at timber sales and how to participate in that public process.
Right, right.
I remember the first time I commented on a BLM timber sale. Well, back up a little bit. I think in 1998, the Northwest Forest Plan came out, and I read it because I've been in forestry for years. And so I read this. I thought, oh, this is pretty good, you know. And then one of BLM's first timber sales was, they wanted to log in a late successional reserve and trade a matrix area for the LSR because of a private land group needed to have access. And it was very complicated. I even forget now what it was all about, but I submitted comments, said, you can't log an LSR. And in those times, we had to make sure we mailed our comments 3 or 4 days before they were due, because there was no such thing as PDFs or internet or anything So soon I got a phone call from BLM, and I was surprised, BLM is calling me? And it was, well, you know, it's not so bad, and don't worry about it, and don't appeal, because that'll cost you a whole lot of time, be so much trouble for you, we'll just talk about it now. And I thought, wow, I must have really hit a sore spot if they called me up.
Yeah.
But absolutely, I appealed it.
Right.
There was an annual event down at Headwaters, had a conference once a year down in Ashland. And they had little groups like, this is NEPA, and what about frogs? You know, they had all these things, and that's where I really learned a lot of how to do this, was at the Headwaters conference, forest conferences that were down in Ashland every year for a while. Hmm. And so,
so
to know that I could influence something, once I realized I can even influence something, that kind of got me hooked.
Yeah, I mean, having the BLM call you directly, that's they clearly misjudged that one. So I'm curious, you know, you're talking about that paperwork side of things and getting involved there. I know that you've also been involved in, you know, blockades and tree sits and that aspect as well. And that was obviously more of a thing back in the 90s, back before the kind of timber wars died down. Curious if you have any good stories you'd like to share about those experiences, or the paper wrenching as well, which is obviously just as important.
Well, I think because we had one of the first websites and paid $5 for each picture we put up, mm-hmm. and we showed old growth forest to be clear cut, I think we attracted people that wanted to do direct action down here to the Umpqua. And so different activists then did things down here in the Umpqua. I mean, one of the very first things they did was block a road to the Little River Road, where there was the last timber sale, and they blocked that road. And it was right by a campground. I slept in that campground and watched them tow an old car and block the road and chain themselves to the bottom of the car. And I thought, and so that was one of the first protests I saw, them dragging away the car. And then we all got arrested and let go right away, and then the charges were dropped. But then later on, the tree climbers wanted to save individual trees. There was a sale called the Snog Timber Sale in the Diamond Lake Ranger District, where a man sat up there, and he never gave us his name. I never knew him. But he sat up there for 6-9 months.
Wow.
Until they dropped that, the Forest Service promised to drop that unit. And it was an incredible old growth forest, you know, right across from a prairie, a natural prairie. We had to walk across to get into this old growth forest. It was incredible. And then there was another tree sit in a sale called Right View. And this was a BLM timber sale, Right View. And it was just outside of Roseburg. And a young woman by the name of Madrone sat in that sale for a long time, and then they logged this timber sale around her, and then she was able to come down and she saved that tree.
Right. So sad.
Yeah. And so I was involved in those actions because I was familiar with which timber sales were the worst, mm-hmm. and whereabouts in those timber sales were the worst, and what roads went to them. And I had all that information because I looked at these since the federal agencies first proposed a project. I knew about it. And we were able, through the internet, we were able to complain and spread the word. So the internet came just in time. It's amazing.
I mean, it's amazing to me how much you all got done without a communication and coordination tool that, and I'm not a particularly young person, but that I still take for granted, you know, just seeing some of the Earth First flyers that went around and it makes me very nostalgic for that kind of organizing, although it must have been in some ways so much more difficult. But also, you know, more personal and probably special in some ways as well. And I do actually want to at some point ask you about some of the changes you've seen over the years, but I wonder if there's any other, I mean, you're still involved in this work. I wonder if there's any other campaigns that throughout the years that stick out in your memory and coming up to the present. What are the kinds of things you're involved in right now?
Well, one of the campaigns that took my life away for years was at the Steve Senator Gas Pipeline. I was sitting in my office at Umpqua Watersheds, and I got a request from Coos Bay BLM to do a line of sight survey, and they're only going to have to cut down small trees that are in the line of light survey. And I complained. I said, well, what about yew trees in the riparian reserve? They could be hundreds of years old. You might cut them down. You should say they can't cut down yew trees, right? So this was my first big complaint. Mm-hmm. Little did I know what the line of sight was for. So I asked, what's it for? Oh, it's a pipeline. And then I got more and more information. It was like, holy cow. You know, it's, was projected to be, 230 miles from Coos Bay to Klamath Falls. Mm-hmm. They had to do a 100-foot wide clear cut through any forest, federal or non-forest, and they had to go over private land of hundreds of landowners. And if the landowner didn't agree for that pipeline to be on their property, they said they would take the land with eminent domain. So here we were. It was like, and then it turned out to be a Canadian company wanting to do this. How can a foreign country take a U.S. citizen's private land with eminent domain? If they're a foreign country, they can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they could. I mean, they figured out ways. And sure. They definitely threatened. And one day they said, we're going to have a meeting. We're going to speak to the public along the South Umpqua River and Days Creek, and we'll tell them how good we're going to be, right? And so me and one of my coworkers said, well, we're going to go to that public meeting. And we made a flyer that says, don't sell. Pipelines are bad because, and I couldn't think of why they were bad, but I thought of put down something, you know. And we went to that meeting and handed out those flyers, you know, just don't say no along the Days Creek River. It's not good for the river. So a couple weeks later, I got a letter in the mail, and I'm a part owner of some land near Days Creek. It's called Oregon Women's Land Trust land. It's Owl Farm. Mm-hmm. And it's right up there at the top of the ridge between the South and North Umpqua. And one day I get the mail for that organization, and I got a letter from hello, we're a pipeline company, and we want to put a little pipeline through your property, and can you just send back, just sign here and send back in the self-addressed stamped envelope we got for you right here.
Wow.
And I went, holy. And so that's when the pipeline changed its route and decided to come through Owl Farm. So not only was I being paid as an environmentalist to fight this pipeline, it went through my own property in a sense. I didn't live there, but I was part of that property. And so, it became quite a fight. It was,
yeah.
I mean, Rogue Climate joined this fight. And when they joined it, they were so good at, I mean, I was good at writing comments and complaining, but Rogue Climate was so good at organizing people and big rallies to Salem, to the governor. You know, they could organize these really super big rallies against it. They were so good and such a big help in fighting this pipeline.
Yeah.
So we fought it for many, many years. They put out three different EISs. The first EIS was to import natural gas, build a pipeline up to Klamath Falls, and ship it to California. And We said, no. They don't need natural gas. We got plenty of natural gas because there's an existing pipeline that comes from Canada down to California on the east side of Highway 97, east side of Oregon. And so, they needed to get gas from that pipeline to the ocean so they could import and export what they want. And that's why they wanted to put the pipeline from Klamath Falls to Coos Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, Patty Goldman, I mean, I never would have accomplished anything. I never would have stopped any timber sale if it hadn't been for the lawyers. It was the lawyers who did all the good work, you know. And so we fought this pipeline until we went to Salem a few times and had these big rallies and organizations. And we told the state, you know, don't sign off on the Clean Water Act. It was up to the state of Oregon to give them the Clean Water Act permission. And they were going to cross hundreds of streams. And they were going to have to clear cut the riparian reserve on hundreds of streams in order to get the machinery down there and dig it up. And we told the state of Oregon, you know, please, please don't do this to your citizens. And so the state of Oregon said, oh, okay, well, we won't give them the Clean Water Act permit. And we won't give them another permit they needed. Maybe it was the Clean Air Act. And so Pacific Connector Pipeline fought for a long time. I think they started in 2013 when I first read about them. And in 2021, we were just going to go to court. The court had started, the hearings had just started for a federal agency that gave them permission for something they shouldn't have. And it was during the beginning of that court hearing that Pacific Connector said, well, we have an announcement to make. We're pulling out. We are no longer proposing this pipeline. We're done. And so I got an email, you know, from Earth Justice. Well, they're done. No more threat. I went, well, I couldn't believe it. It's like, when you spend your whole life on it for years, it's like, oh, well, what do I do now? But I haven't got anything to complain about right now. Oh, no.
I mean, that the fight against, you call it the Pacific Connector Pipeline. A lot of folks know it as the Jordan Cove Pipeline.
Right.
And I mean, I think that's one of the iconic battles in the Northwest in the last couple decades. And it didn't get quite as much attention as some of the coal export terminals that were proposed closer to Portland and up by Seattle, et cetera, et cetera. But it was an absolutely huge fight. And I did not know until just now that you were in there right at the ground level before any of the NGOs had, sounds like, had even really gotten on their radar. That's amazing.
They did three EISs and asked for public comments three times, of which especially the last one was their really go-to one, you know, and I was very experienced in writing comments at this time. So a lot of environmental groups really appreciated the group work Umpqua Watersheds and later Cascadia Wildlands mm-hmm. was against that pipeline. And a lot of groups signed on to our comments. A lot of groups wrote their own comments. I mean, it was a statewide fight.
Yeah.
But I got done with this.
Oh, yeah. So inspiring, the work you all did on that.
Well, we're a little worried. Back in last year, because when you sign on to the FERC site for a project number, you get all the emails sent into FERC on that project number.
That's Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Right. And they're the ones in charge of overseeing this pipeline. Unlike the Forest Service, unlike BLM, this is the Federal Energy Regulatory Service. And so we got a notice from FERC in 2024 that they were reconsidering the pipeline. And we all went, ah! And we came to each other, you know, we hadn't done it for years. And we found out that it was just a scam guy just decided to upset
nice.
And post it in there. But now, though, that Trump wants to expand natural gas, we're a little worried because, you know, the route has been all figured out. There's been a few people who have given a right of passage. And how much? And so if they wanted to raise this issue again, they would have a lot less work than those they had back in 2015.
At least at the federal level, right? Yeah. I mean, you're looking at a administration that is openly hostile to anything positive to the environment and basically completely beholden to the fossil fuel interest. But, you know, fortunately, it doesn't rest just with the feds. And fortunately, we still have folks like you around. But yeah, somebody at some point needs to do like a full oral history of that, because I mean, there are just so many amazing elements. They were building their own police force in Coos Bay. They were working with the Medford police to illegally spy on activists in Southern Oregon. I mean, it's quite an exciting saga.
There's a ongoing lawsuit for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I could talk with you about the Jordan Cove thing forever, but I just want to say yeah.
The reason why this was so important to stop,
yeah,
because it would have been the largest carbon pollution in the state of Oregon. It would emit more carbon than any other industry. And I tell you, it's hard to bypass the timber industry as far as carbon.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. You can hear the second half of our conversation on the Coast Range Radio podcast feed. Just skip ahead to about minute 28. Coast Range Radio is an independent production. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience, tell your friends about us, share us on the socials, all that good stuff. Once again, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and